this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Who Owns the Warehouse District? An in-depth look at the West Martin Street corridor in the hottest redevelopment zone in downtown Raleigh. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Here Comes the New Downtown Raleigh. And this article is written by Amanda Hoyle. Johnny Boyette has been rebuilding customized motors for car collectors and racetrack drivers from the machine shop his dad opened on Raleigh's West Martin Street in 1949 since he was old enough to see over the hood of a car. The shop used to be surrounded by businesses like his, he says. Cheap warehouse space, dirt storage yards, and small businesses including tire sales, furniture manufacturing, roofing materials, and paint supplies, and even burial vaults, the types of establishments where a skilled laborer could still eke out a living. Nowadays, though, most of the buildings around Boyette's Automotive Performance Machine Shop are filled with tech workers and sales professionals who know more about writing computer code and pitching a business plan than repairing a cylinder head. It's also quieter. We fired up a drag boat the other day and everybody in the neighborhood was raising heck, he says. It was loud, but I'm not used to people complaining about it. Much of Raleigh's warehouse district, running along the train tracks parallel to West Street, has been in a steady transformation over the past decade. Business startups taking advantage of the cheaper building prices have worked with real estate developers to turn many of the old warehouses into creative spaces for office workers. The CAM, C-A-M, Raleigh Contemporary Art Museum opened in a renovated warehouse building at 409 West Martin Street in 2011, and other spaces nearby have been turned into art galleries and design studios. Once Citrix moved its ShareFile subsidiary office with about 750 sales and technology workers in Raleigh into its state-of-the-art digs in the Warehouse District in 2014, the makeover was well on its way. Now attention has turned to the block surrounding Citrix, particularly the east-west corridor along West Main Street that will connect a new downtown anchor with another. The $88 million Union Station passenger train and transit terminal, slated to open in late 2017, and the historic Nash Square City Park. Tax values for properties on both sides of West Martin Street have more than doubled in the 8 years since Wake County's last property tax revaluation in 2008, and in some cases more than tripled in value. The Citrix campus itself sold for $68.5 million only months after it opened, setting a new $370 per square foot price record for a commercial building in the Triangle. Warehouse District prospectors, who weren't already in before the real estate recession hit in 2008, have been more in a wait-and-see mode. Only three property sales have been recorded along the West Martin Street corridor since 2013, two of which qualified as distress sales by the former owners. That trend, however, is expected to shift with the start of construction in February at Union Station and the redevelopment of the Dillon Supply Warehouse. Office vacancy in the warehouse district was less than 1% in the fourth quarter, and when spaces do come available, there's usually a waiting list of potential tenants. Meanwhile, owners, tenants, and investors from across the market are eyeing West Martin Street as millions are being invested to redevelop the area and rental rates and real estate prices climb higher and higher. There's not been much turnover in that area, says James Sauls, economic development manager for the city of Raleigh. And with the Dillon being the newest, shiniest toy, everyone's waiting to see how that's going to get flushed out with all the office and retail space it will be bringing. Values rising. For some current property owners along Martin Street, while the long-term prospects look rosy, the immediate impact comes with a hefty tax bill. Raleigh attorney Drew Sprague says he's appealing the $2.4 million property tax value that the county's appraisers have estimated his law firm's office building and parking lot are worth next to Nash Square. He paid $679,000 for the property in 2011. On the other hand, Sprague says he's also anticipating that his block of buildings, now zoned for a 20-story structure, could one day get scooped up by an enterprising real estate investor for the right price. We field blind offers all the time from speculators who think we may not know the correct price point of our property, Sprague says. Trust us, we know what it's worth. The real estate market on West Martin Street is popping. For now, Johnny Boyette says he hasn't heard any offers from developers wanting his 0.11-acre lot and machine shop building that's between the CAM, Raleigh Art Museum, and the workshop where Raleigh Denim crafts its $280 denim jeans. HQ Raleigh, the entrepreneurial co-working hub next to the art museum, is reevaluating its plan to build a five-story office expansion. As we got into figuring out the job site and the financials, that plan sort of shifted, said HQ Raleigh Executive Coordinator Christy Quackenbush on a recent Urban Land Institute walking tour of Raleigh's warehouse district. We still hope to have something built in the next 18 months. A new skyline. One block away, though, Raleigh real estate developer John Kane and his real estate partners have started picking apart a former Dillon Supply Company warehouse that covers nearly a whole city block between Martin and Hargett Streets. They'll use the shell of the building as a foundation to build the $125 million 17-story office, apartment, and retail tower, the Dillon. The building is slated to open in 2018. The city's new Unified Development Ordinance map and downtown plan adopted in 2015 have also planted seeds for turning many of the non-historic single and two-story structures surrounding Nash Square and Martin Street into multi-story office, retail, hotel, and parking structures. When Kane Realty first proposed its plan for a 20-story Dillon project, it met with considerable resistance from neighbors related to the height of the building and the skyline views it would block. But the 17-story compromise plan that includes increased public parking options has been mostly applauded by community leaders. Ideally for us, we're looking to find a place to create a vibrant community that maybe is more transformational, Kane Realty Development Director T.J. Barringer told the group on the ULI tour. It's also a little bit of a passion internally, taking a place that's got a lot of potential. By the time you're finished, hopefully, people are there enjoying it and have a different level of community. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by Managing Editor Rebecca Troyer. Durham firms team up on virtual demo. A Durham video production company is hoping what happens in Las Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas, but leads to more contracts. Horizon Productions teamed up with LED Giant Cree to show store managers what products were coming next through an interactive display at the Home Depot trade show in Las Vegas this month. Horizon Multimedia Director Jason Cooper and team created what he calls a virtual reality experience for Cree by recreating a Home Depot store. The goal was to transport store managers to a Home Depot, all so they could see what Cree's next generation products would look like on the shelves. To do it, Cooper and team went into a Home Depot after hours, cleaned out an entire bay, and shot a 360-degree video. Then, when store managers put on the headsets, we transported them into a Home Depot, he says. Art Pappas earns military distinction. Prominent Durham venture capitalist Art Pappas calls it the proudest moment of his life. He received a call from the Pentagon stating he had been inducted to the 101st Airborne, 327th Infantry's Distinguished Member of the Regiment. I have tried to keep my military experience pretty private, Papa says, so this really was stunning. In an effort to provide a vital link to the unit's past and to build upon the esprit de corps enjoyed by this unit, we are proud to welcome you as a Distinguished Member of the Regiment, read the note from Colonel Rob Campbell, commander of the 1st Brigade of the 101st Airborne Division in the regiment. Pappas was inducted last year. Execs travel to White House to tout international trade. On March 21, two Triangle women executives were present at the White House as part of about 30 business leaders across the nation to lend their support to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. April Ellerby, Director of Sales and Services at the Durham Convention and Visitors Bureau, and Pat Cresido, President and CEO of the Desert Harvest Company in Hillsboro, spoke authoritatively about why TPP will benefit their organizations. International trade helps support more than 1.7 million travel and tourism jobs in the United States. LRB told the attendees, hosted by Robert Holleyman, Deputy U.S. Trade Representative. The Trans-Pacific Partnership would expand access to 11 international markets, and increasing international trade boosts the number of international visitors who come to the United States for business and leisure. Congress should pass the agreement soon to create more jobs here in Durham and across the country. Cresido sounded equally insistent about Congress passing the TPP pact. At Desert Harvest, we've been able to grow our company thanks to customers in more than 42 countries around the world, Cresido said. But it's not always easy to export our products internationally because other countries have different rules and regulations for healthcare products. Bronto Women Launch Professional Group. 50 women from various departments at Bronto Software in Durham at various career stages recently launched Women in NetSuite, or WIN, Durham. NetSuite acquired Bronto in 2015. The group's mission is to advance the professional development of women at NetSuite through recruitment, sponsorship, networking, education, and advocacy, according to a company blog post. Here's what NetSuite says about the WIN chapters at its headquarters in San Mateo, California, and other offices around the globe. Why is this a priority for NetSuite? It's not just an initiative to provide more career or networking opportunities. Studies have consistently shown that having women in leadership positions leads to more profitable businesses. We also want a diverse workplace. That's better for everyone at NetSuite, the partners we work with, and the customers we serve. Diversity is key to winning the talent war and increasing the bottom line. It's necessary for our future successes. And in a section called He Said It, the quote, business schools benefit greatly from engaging a broad constituency of business partners and listening to their requirements for their employees. In the business climate of today, business schools have to quickly react to the expectations of the business community or they will risk being irrelevant. And that's from Kevin O'Mara, who was named Dean of the Lundy Fetterman School of Business at Campbell University, effective July 1. And now in the Triangle Business, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, Inside Blount Street Homes, Tours of Historic Homes Before Sale Reveals Condition of Fixer-Uppers. Buyers have so far stepped forward for 11 of the 12 historic homes that the State Property Office began marketing for sale in 2015, an effort that will generate almost $6.17 million in sales revenue for the state once the deals close. The total is about 16% more than the appraised value of the properties that have been vacant for years. It's a win-win for everybody, says John LaPenta, Deputy Secretary in the North Carolina Department of Administration. The department is in charge of marketing the state-owned buildings targeted by Project Phoenix, the code name for Governor Pat McCrory's initiative to improve many of the state government's property assets in the capital city and across the state. Plus, the city of Raleigh loves it because these properties will now be added back to their tax rolls, LaPenta says. On a recent tour through eight of the homes being sold along Blount, Person, and Lane Streets between the governor's executive mansion and the state capitol building, Joy Wayman, a real estate agent at the State Property Office, points out the ornately carved brass door hinges of the Andrews Duncan House, the nearly 16-foot floor-to-ceiling mirrors in the Heck Andrews House, and the lack of any electrical or water utilities in the Worth Watson and Gay houses. The Worth Watson and Gay houses used to be offices for state government agencies until they were moved by truck from Pierce Street to Person Street in 2008. Nothing, however, has been done to the interior or the exterior of the buildings since then. Wayman says all of the new owners have already approved for the purchase of the houses were given ample time to tour the properties along with their consultants and contractors before putting in any offers on the houses. All of the houses are being sold as is, meaning that the state won't be responsible for new repairs before the close of the sale. Each will also require extensive renovation that could take several months and even years of repair work by the new owners. The McGee House, the newest of the homes but in the worst condition, might even need to be demolished. The buyer of the Cobble Helms House Nextdoor has agreed to buy both it and the McGee House for $710,000. Only the Hart House at 421 North Blunt Street, built circa 1879, remains unsold. It is listed for $800,000. Wayman notes that the state has twice paid for major rehabilitation to the exterior of the landmark Heck Andrews House. There are even fresh annuals planted along its front walkway, but it has never put any money into the renovation of the interior space. As such, it is currently uninhabitable, with peeling paint and rotting floorboards in many of the rooms. I hope I get invited back when it's restored, Wayman says. Connect North Carolina Bond. Here's how state bond proceeds will be spent in the Triangle. While none of the $2 billion in Connect North Carolina bond money approved by a statewide vote on March 15 will benefit the deteriorating buildings in Raleigh's downtown state government district, the Triangle will still get a fair share of proceeds from the referendum. More than 130 different projects on university and community college campuses, state parks, and other state-owned facilities across North Carolina have been earmarked for the bond funds. Here's a list of the top projects from the Triangle region. Construction of new agriculture and consumer services lab building for veterinary, food, drug, and motor fuel testing in Wake County, $94 million. New Plant Sciences Initiative Building, a partnership project between the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and NC State University at Centennial Campus in Raleigh, $85 million. Construction of new engineering oval building at NC State University Centennial Campus in Raleigh, $75 million. Replacement of Berry Hill Hall, a medical education building at UNC Chapel Hill, $68 million. And construction of new building for NC Central University's School of Business in Durham, $30 million. FedEx, Peter Millar, planning new distribution plants in Durham. Real estate developers working on behalf of logistics giant FedEx and luxury sportswear brand Peter Millar are moving forward with plans to build new warehouse distribution system facilities expected to open later in 2016. Charlotte-based SunCap Property Group has acquired the former Sumitomo Electric Lightwave Manufacturing Plant property on a major thoroughfare through Research Triangle Park with plans to redevelop the site with a new building for FedEx. The proposed $39 million FedEx project is expected to create more than 350 new jobs, according to a resolution adopted by Durham City Council in February, pledging support for the developers' efforts seeking off-site road improvements from the North Carolina Department of Transportation. SunCap on March 16 closed on the purchase of the 48-acre property at 78 T.W. Alexander Drive in Durham from Sumitomo Electric, paying $10.5 million for the property. Down the road, Scannell Properties of Indianapolis, Indiana, is building a 115,000-square-foot new warehouse building at the TBC Industrial Park on Stirrup Creek Drive that will be solely occupied by the distribution operations of apparel brand Peter Millar. Myers to lead downtown Durham in interim. The Board of Downtown Durham Incorporated has appointed Lou Myers, a fixture among the downtown Durham business community for more than 30 years, to serve as interim CEO and president of the Downtown Booster Organization until a new leader can be found. Jeff Durham, who has served as president and CEO of Downtown Durham Incorporated since 2013, has been hired as the new president and CEO of the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce. He starts his new job April 1. Myers is also principal and director of business development for the North Carolina practice of Perkins Will, a global design firm. And finally, in a section called Restaurant Retail, Chapel Hill's One Restaurant and Durham's G2B Restaurant and Brewery are closing. The owners of both the Fine Dining One Restaurant at Meadowmont Village in Chapel Hill and the G2B Restaurant and Brewery in Durham have announced they will be closing on April 2. One restaurant, opened since 2010, is closing as co-executive chefs Clem Floresca and Daniel Ryan have decided to leave. G2B had been serving contemporary American cuisine almost 5 years and added a nano brewery just 2 years ago. The location at the corner of University Drive and Shannon Road had been an unfortunate location, as prior to G2B, it was home to Starlu, which also lasted only a few years. Raleigh Raw opens juice bar on Harget Street. After exceeding their $37,000 Kickstarter fundraising goal in January, Raleigh Raw co-owners Sharif Aoud and Leslie Woods have opened for business. Their new shop space is at 7 West Harget Street, between the CVS drugstore and the Deco Raleigh gift shop, in the shadow of the Wells Fargo Capital Center Tower. Raleigh Raw specializes in raw, organic, and cold-pressed fruit and vegetable juices sold in 17-ounce bottles. Fish and Chips Food Truck finds permanent home in downtown Raleigh. Oak City Fish and Chips, a triangle-based food truck, has opened a permanent site in downtown Raleigh that will be open for lunch and dinner. A truck is now parked at 511 South Wilmington Street, a private lot that a representative of the food truck owner, The Mobile Kitchen, says they are leasing from McLaurin Parking Company. A second fish and chips truck will continue making its rounds around various Triangle locations. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline: GSK's Zebulin drug gets big ad dollars. GlaxoSmithKline has thrown a hefty consumer marketing campaign behind Anoro Ellipta, one of the next generation respiratory drugs the pharmaceutical giant hopes will backfill declining Advair sales. However, in the first year, GSK spent nearly as much on Anoro consumer advertising as it generated in Anoro revenue. GSK spent $102 million on direct-to-consumer advertising related to Anoro Ellipta last year, according to data provided by the Nielsen Company. The figure includes advertising on television and radio and in magazines and newspapers. That amount ranks the drug as number 17 on a list of DTC ad spending by drug, a list that includes commonly advertised products like Cialis, Lyrica, and Chantix. In 2015, those advertising dollars did not translate to big sales. Anoro Ellipta, a COPD treatment, accounted for just $121 million in total sales last year after becoming available in the United States in April 2014. Anoro Ellipta, as well as asthma treatment Brio Ellipta, are manufactured in Zebulin. Contrast those figures with Cialis, the erectile dysfunction treatment marketed by Eli Lilly and Company. It recorded the most DTC advertising spend at more than $220 million, some 30% more than the number two drug last year, according to Nielsen. Eli Lilly reported $2.3 billion in total Cialis sales last year, though it is a far more established product. For years, GSK leaned heavily on the asthma treatment Advair, also manufactured in Zebulin, a drug that topped $8 billion in sales in 2013. However, as GSK loses patent protection and faces higher competition, it has looked to the next generation, and especially Anoro Ellipta and Brio Ellipta, to make up for the decline in Advair revenue. GSK leadership has stayed positive about its respiratory lines. In a February conference call to discuss earnings, CEO Andrew Witty said, "We continue to be extremely positive about our short, medium, and long-run respiratory growth opportunities." And in a section called He Said It, the quote, "While the past few months have been difficult, Valeant has a collection of leading brands, valuable franchises, and great people. And I am confident that the company will be able to rebuild its reputation and thrive under new leadership." And that is from Bob Ingram, board chairman of Valeant Pharmaceuticals International Incorporated and titan of the Triangle pharmaceutical industry, on the day Valeant announced it would look for a CEO to replace Michael Pearson. And the next quote, "The GSK reputation and global brand have played a significant role in building the pharmaceutical brand throughout the RTP region. Their investment in our community has enhanced the reputation of our research universities and encouraged other industry leaders to invest as well." And that's from Bob Giolis, president and CEO of the Research Triangle Foundation, on the day GlaxoSmithKline CEO Andrew Witty announced he would retire. The Glaxo operations and RTP have had highs and lows under Witty's tenure. And finally, a section called Big Numbers, 65% drop in share price of Durham-based drug developer Heat Biologics the day it priced a secondary public offering. Heat will offer nearly 16 million shares and warrants in an attempt to raise $6.8 million. $20 million by 52. Investment and jobs planned by New Jersey-based Braeburn Pharmaceuticals in a new manufacturing and research facility in Durham County. $1.1 million and 22. Investment and new chemical dependency beds proposed by Triangle Springs, a mental and behavioral health hospital in Wake County. If approved, Triangle Springs would increase capacity to 34 beds focused on drug and alcohol addiction treatment. And $180 million. Shortfall of Xifaxan sales. Valiant Pharmaceuticals International acquired the IBS-D drug when it bought Salix Pharmaceuticals. Valiant projected Q4 sales of $390 million, but actual revenue came in at only $210 million. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onisorge. The main headline, Durham's GE Aviation to help fill $145 billion engine backorder. Chances are a future flight will be powered by Durham technology, whether you know it or not. GE Aviation in Durham is ripe with activity as its engineers prepare to meet a 10,000 engine backorder for next generation airplane technology. New LEAP engines for both Boeing and Airbus commercial planes are currently in the testing pipeline, explains Alan Kelly, the plant leader at the GV Aviation Durham engine facility. But over the next few months, the products move from testing to production, and that means a facility overhaul. About 315 technicians and 30 support staff last year shipped more than 2,000 engines out of the Durham facility, which is the most efficient facility that we have in the GE Aviation network, Kelly says. A volume of 2,000, however, falls short of what's already on back order for the LEAP, 10,000 engines or more than $145 billion in merchandise. Through a joint venture partnership with SNECMA, GE is only on the hook for about half of that volume, but the Durham facility still can't do it alone, even with jobs it's currently adding to the facility. So GE is currently building a facility in Lafayette, Indiana, to help take some of Durham's load off the lines, which will give us the capacity to look ahead at the next engine type being designed today in Cincinnati, Kelly says. That engine, the GE9X for the Boeing 777X, is targeted to be built in Durham. GE has also extended job offers to a handful of people in Durham to help it meet its backlog and expects to introduce an additional 15 employees in the near future, he says. The hiring process, like everything else at the facility, is highly complicated, with a series of screenings as well as an 8-hour facility assessment where candidates who come from all over, including local universities, are evaluated both for technical aptitude and teamwork. The Durham unit is unique in that nearly one-third of its employees are veterans. Across the company, that statistic is just about 7%, Kelly says. What Lenovo's executive shuffle means for the Triangle? 4 years, five North American heads. Lenovo announced its latest management shuffle March 18, one that puts Emilio Gilardi at the head of the North American operation, which is based in Morrisville. TBR analyst Jack Narcotta says the move shows how aggressively Lenovo is pursuing the region. The U.S. market in particular is very challenging, he said in an interview following the announcement. You've just got these companies that have not only put roots down already, but the proverbial root system goes wide and deep. And if a game plan isn't working, it's clear Lenovo isn't shy about shifting personnel, Narcotta says. Gilardi has served as Chief Operating Officer of North America since July at Lenovo and held previous leadership positions at Hewlett-Packard and AMD. Lenovo's North American heads over the past 4 years: David Schmuck left the Lenovo North Carolina role in 2012 for Dell, where he currently serves as President, End User Computing Sales. Jerry Smith took over for Schmuck, having previously been Senior Vice President of Global Operations at Lenovo. With March 18 announcement, he'll be president of the new Lenovo Data Center Group, based in RTP. He'll remain in Silicon Valley, but will spend his time in RTP and all around the world as he runs a global business, Lenovo spokeswoman Malanka Mukhi says. Jay Parker left the post for a Lenovo promotion in 2015 before taking on a role at Dell, where he currently serves as general manager for the North American Enterprise Systems Group. Aymar de Lequesing took over for Parker, and in a move announced March 18, takes the helm of the Motorola Mobile Business Group in April as chairman and president. And finally, in a section called They Said It, Apple admits that Valencell brought a prototype watch to a meeting with Apple employees in the summer of 2013 and admits that one or more of the Apple employees in attendance was involved in the hardware design of the Apple Watch. Apple denies that the heart rate monitor of the Valencell prototype watch was substantially similar to the Apple Watch. From Apple's March 21 counterclaim in response to a lawsuit filed in January by Raleigh-based Valencell claiming Apple infringed on Valencell's patents when it developed its Apple Watch. Apple denies the infringement and asks the court to declare certain Valencell patents invalid. Valencell develops sensors for use in wearable devices and has licensing deals for its technology with several companies, including LG Electronics. And now we turn to a Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal, written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. We start with his column, the headline, UNC Newspaper Scoops for Funds. The Daily Tar Heel, the 123-year-old student newspaper at UNC Chapel Hill, is adding charitable fundraising to the nonprofit business model it launched in 1989. Founded in 1893 as a publication of the school's athletic association, the DTH, for most of its history, was supported by fees from students who picked the editor in a campus-wide election. But in 1993, a student referendum ended the student fee and put the selection of the editor in the hands of an independent board created by the board of directors of a nonprofit created at the time to publish the newspaper. Advertising sales had been generating enough revenue to cover operating costs, and the newspaper wanted to give student fees back for other campus organizations to use, while also removing even the possible appearance of influence from the university, says Kelly Wolf, general manager and director of the nonprofit DTH Media Corporation. For the past 5 years, however, the nonprofit has posted an annual operating deficit ranging from $50,000 to more than $100,000 on a budget of about $1 million, making up the difference from reserves. It now needs to replace outmoded newsroom technology and provide scholarships for student staff, she says. It has formed an alumni association to spearhead an annual fund campaign and host receptions throughout the U.S., and it is preparing for a capital campaign to raise about $300,000. We are starting for the first time to ask our alumni to support the parts of our educational mission that are no longer being fully supported by our ad revenue, Wolf says. Operating in an office in downtown Chapel Hill and with a professional staff of 6 people, the newspaper employs 80 students in news, advertising, customer service, and production jobs. Another 150 students work as volunteers in training. The student staff produces 14,000 copies of the newspaper 5 days per week when school is in session. The paper is distributed at 225 sites on and off campus, including Chapel Hill, Carrboro, Hillsboro, Southeast Durham, and Northern Chatham County. An online version of the newspaper attracts about 10,500 unique visitors each school day. The student editor hires the newsroom staff, each of whom is paid $200 to $700 per month. DTH Media Corporation employs a newsroom advisor who provides training for staff and volunteers. A student advertising manager and staff of 25 handle all ad sales under the direction of a non-student advertising director. Last fall, DTH Media Corporation began piloting a new business, DTH Media Services, with public relations students from UNC working with clients to produce brand content. Their new alumni association has developed a list of 2,000 alumni, will distribute an alumni newsletter 3 times a year, and in February hosted a 2-day inaugural homecoming event. The Alumni Association, Wolf says, will focus on fundraising, networking among alumni for professional development, and mentoring students. And in nonprofit news, Youth Lead Anti-Violence Conference. The National Association of Students Against Violence Everywhere, SAVE, a nonprofit dedicated to decreasing the potential for violence in our schools and communities, brought together students and community leaders from around the nation for its youth-led SAVE Summit on March 12. The annual conference and workshop, which was held in Raleigh, provides students with leadership resources and support by engaging, educating, and empowering them to have open conversations about violence and how to prevent it. Junior League hosts Belk Fashion Night. The Junior League of Raleigh and Belk will host the 2016 Love My League Fashion Night, formerly known as Fashion Forward, on April 17. The event is the signature fundraiser for the Junior League, in which shoppers can preview the latest in Belk's fashion trends. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page. And the first Viewpoint column that we read is written by Daryl M. West, who is Vice President and Director of Government Studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. The headline on his column, Zero Rating, Is It Good for Net Neutrality? On March 17, T-Mobile announced that YouTube has joined its Binge On program, which allows video content on the mobile carrier's network to be zero rated or not counted against data caps. Although the concept of zero rating appeals to consumers who routinely max out their data plans watching internet video, the program has drawn some criticism from activists who see the well-meaning program potentially undermining the principles of net neutrality, which aspires to enable equal access to all content and services transmitted on the internet. Zero rating, an asset for the developing world and a wireless innovation. Aside from first-world consumers maxing out their data plans watching Netflix, zero rating is a useful tool in the developing world. According to a panel discussion at Internet Governance Forum in 2014, IGF 2014, zero rating has the potential to, quote, bring down the cost of access to information in less developed countries, unquote. Both Wikipedia and Facebook have launched zero-rated versions of their sites for developing countries to give individuals access to their services without paying for the data. They argue that zero rating drastically lowers the cost of internet, which can account for 10% of a monthly income in developing countries. Additionally, Verizon and AT&T have launched sponsored data plans that essentially promise that data used by the app or service is essentially free to customers. Comcast argues that its Stream TV zero-rated service is also exempt from the Federal Communication Commission's net neutrality rule since it delivers content over Comcast cable rather than internet. For many companies, the rollout of zero rating has gained the attention of regulators like the FCC. At an Open Technology Institute event this year, T-Mobile Senior Vice President of Government Affairs, Kathleen Hamm, said the FCC should tread lightly as companies explore the potential that zero rating has for innovation and consumers. Zero rating, a Trojan horse intended to weaken net neutrality. Despite the rush for some companies to embrace zero rating, some activists have questioned whether the benefits outweigh the potential erosion of net neutrality. John LeGear, T-Mobile's vocal, animated, and sometimes foul-mouthed CEO, got himself into trouble last year when answering concerns from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, a group that has been skeptical of zero rating. After investigating Ben John, EFF found that T-Mobile is throttling video streams, plain and simple. In attempting to deliver streaming video content across its network, T-Mobile's Binge On service actually throttles video streams that haven't opted in to the service. EFF and others say this infraction is a clear violation of the FCC's open internet rules enacted last year. Barbara Van Schewick, a professor and researcher from Stanford, published a study directly challenging T-Mobile's zero-rated program, accusing it of, quote, harming competition, innovation, user choice, and free speech on the internet, unquote. Even the positive effects of zero rating in the developing world are challenged. Despite offering lower-cost internet, critics say these programs simply offer poor internet for poor people, an inherently unequal system that should not be supported. As Mahesh Murthy writes for Quartz India, the only way the second world and the third world can grow is to behave like their first world nations and demand to be treated on par with every other net citizen in the world. While the U.S. and many developing countries have adopted a wait-and-see approach to zero rating, some countries have found the activity to be discriminatory. As a result, Chile, Norway, Netherlands, Finland, Iceland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Malta, and Japan have all restricted zero rating within their borders. As discussed at IGF 2014, it may be practically and politically difficult to introduce neutrality requirements after carriers have normalized the process of providing preferential access to certain online content and service providers. Despite these reactions, zero rating is marching on. And our next Viewpoint page column is written by Andrew Broad, who is a senior research fellow at UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. His headline, Time Finances Hold Back Entrepreneurism in North Carolina. One of the mantras of the modern economic development is that we must foster entrepreneurship. As a result, programs in entrepreneurship are everywhere, in high schools, community colleges, and universities, and there's no reason not to include entrepreneurship among the tools that a region uses to invigorate its economy. But we need to be clear about the limitations of the approach. After all tools have limitations. Improving the education and skills of a regional workforce is a fantastic thing to do, but it takes a long time. What are the drawbacks of an entrepreneurship-led economic strategy? The first is that we appear to be botching the job already. The U.S. is becoming less, not more, entrepreneurial. The age distribution of businesses is rising, which means that the economy is increasingly weighted toward older, not younger, companies. There are fewer startup companies now, relative to the size of the economy, than a few decades ago, and startups are failing in greater numbers than ever before. To a large degree, the rising failure rate is a function of persistent dysfunction in our financial markets. It is still tremendously difficult to get business loans as banks continue to find other ways to make a profit. A second limitation is that fostering entrepreneurship has a long gestation period. Perhaps that's not surprising. The rate of technology startups, the kind we care most about due to their potential to create good-paying jobs, is correlated with educational attainment. In other words, an area without a lot of college and grad school degrees tends not to create a lot of technology companies. So if it takes a long time for educational improvements to take root, it makes sense that it would also take a long time before we see scads of tech startups. A third limitation of the rush to entrepreneurship is that it has distributional implications. That is, entrepreneurship isn't a ticket to the 1%. Successful entrepreneurs are likely to be part of the 1% already. As with anything else, having resources and connections pays off, and the people with such assets tend not to be 99%ers. Nothing here is meant to suggest that we shouldn't continue to find ways to help people start businesses. If anything, we need more of that than ever before. But given the obstacles in the path of entrepreneurial development, we need to be realistic about what it can do for us. And now we turn to the Washington Watch page in the Triangle Business Journal with an article written by Kent Hoover. The headline, big business benefits the most from state economic development spending, study finds. Two-thirds of state economic development spending benefits big businesses, according to a sample of three states analyzed by Good Jobs First. Large companies are the beneficiaries of at least 69% of economic development spending in Florida, 65% in Missouri, and 70% in New Mexico, the study found. Small businesses benefited from less than 20% of economic development spending in these states. The beneficiaries of the balance in economic development spending could not be discerned. State economic development resources are skewed to create a winner-take-all economy where large corporations win the lion's share of job subsidy spending, Good Jobs First's study concludes. There's a galling mismatch between how governors and other state officials characterize their support for small businesses and what they actually spend, said Greg Leroy, executive director of Good Jobs First. The Washington, D.C.-based organization promotes accountability in economic development. Its findings should raise eyebrows because small businesses employ half of the nation's private workforce and have a much harder time getting the capital they need to grow than large businesses do. Plus, the small business startups that do succeed create more net new jobs than older large businesses, which tend to shed more jobs than they create, according to the Kauffman Foundation. The findings confirm what leaders of small business organizations told Good Jobs First in an earlier survey. An overwhelming majority believe state economic development incentive programs favor big businesses. Plus, another Good Jobs First study looked at 4,228 economic incentive awards in 14 states and found that 70% of the deals and 90% of the money went to large companies. This trend toward helping big businesses instead of small businesses has accelerated in recent years as states have awarded mega deals to a small number of very large companies, Good Jobs First writes. It cites the $145 million awarded to General Electric by Massachusetts and Boston in order to lure GE's headquarters from Connecticut, and the $1.3 billion deal in Nevada to attract Tesla's new battery factory. The new study takes a broader look at state economic development programs. Good Jobs First chose Florida, Missouri, and New Mexico because they published good data on state economic development spending, have diverse economies, and because they have all had robust recent debates about the use and abuse of economic development dollars, according to the report. The bias in favor of big business is compelling evidence that economic development spending has strayed far from its original mission of correcting market failures, Leroy said. An incentive is supposedly intended to enable something that should happen but won't happen until public dollars reduce private risk. But it's hard to see how tax breaks are really influencing companies with access to credit, well-established markets, and deep pools of management talent. Instead, those resources really could help smaller firms still struggling with the credit crunch lingering from the Great Recession. And in the small business section of the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the column written by James Lee, who is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. The headline on his column, Family Tensions Can Affect Non-Family Employees. Here's how the story was told to me. It was a fine little family-owned company, second generation, averaging about $5 million to $6 million in goods in its good years. No match for Microsoft, but I think you could call it successful. The CEO, John, had the majority of the stock. Bobby, John's son and my boss, was executive VP. When I was hired as vice president for product development, I was told that Bobby was in line to take over the company when John retired. I could work hard and make good money there, Bobby said, but forget about going for the top job. It was his to lose. A couple of other family members worked for the company. John's niece, Melanie, was the marketing VP, handling the advertising and press releases and keeping the corporate image all bright and shiny. She was a ball of fire, really ambitious. And John's sister, Barbara, Melanie's mother, worked part-time in the executive office. She'd inherited a lot of company stock, too, and she liked to keep an eye on the business. Nice people to work for, everybody getting along together. until I started noticing that Bobby wasn't around as much as he used to be. When I first joined the company, it was impossible to beat Bobby to the office in the mornings. But then he started coming in later and later, 10:30, 11 o'clock. Some days he didn't come in at all. If I needed a signature on something, I'd just have to sit on it until Bobby showed up. It really cramped the operation. Things got so bad that I went to Bobby's office one afternoon and said, "Maybe we ought to change the approval procedures." "What's wrong with the procedures?" he asked. "Well," I said, "if you're going to be out of the office a lot, I could start checking things with your dad or..." "Listen," Bobby said, his face getting red. "Don't go running to my father about me being out of the office. It's none of your business. We're sticking with the procedures." So I dropped it. A few weeks later, Barbara, the CEO's sister, and Melanie stopped by my office. "It's no secret that things have been a little difficult around here lately," Barbara said. "I know you're loyal to Bobby, but John might have to make some changes." "Say what?" I thought. "But let me tell you," Melanie added, "that I'll want you to stay on." When those two left, other people stuck their heads in to find out what was going on. The tension down at the boss's end of the building was thicker than molasses. It looked like the family was ready to blow, and the employees were getting real nervous. All I could tell them was I didn't have anything to tell them. It hit the fan when Bobby went AWOL for more than 2 weeks. I threw up my hands and went to John's office. Barbara and Melanie were already there. "Sit down," John said to me. "You might as well hear this." Barbara was telling John that Bobby had to go. Productivity was way down, she reminded him. Customers were walking, and employee morale was dropping fast. For the first time in 30 years, the company was in a real crisis. "I can handle Bobby's job, Uncle John," Melanie announced, "and when the time comes, I can handle the company, too." John stared out the window. "I can't fire my own son," he said, "and I won't consider someone else as my successor. Bobby will get himself together." He looked at me. "I'm going to count on you to give him the support he needs." "Me?" I thought. "Why me?" I tried to talk Bobby into doing his job, and then I tried to cover for him. Needless to say, Barbara and Melanie didn't drop by my office again. The other employees couldn't figure out what my role was, so they didn't trust me either. John would only say, "He's my boy, but he's your responsibility." I had to leave. Then others left, and the company kind of drifted away. That was 16 years and 2 jobs ago, but I still can't figure out why some family businesses don't think about the people outside the family who are affected by their decisions. Customers, vendors, and most of all, their employees. The family is at the heart of every family business, but when that heart overrules the head, when family interests overrule business interests, a lot of good people can get hurt. And also in the small business section, we'll turn to the 9-to-5 section. Walston firm wins Master's Cup for relocation services. Triangle-based Coldwell banker Howard Perry in Walston, CBHPW, was recently awarded the prestigious Master's Cup by Cartus Corporation for its relocation services and performance results in 2015. The award was presented at the 2016 Cartus Broker Network International Conference in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Cartus Corporation, a global company offering employee relocation services, awards the annual Master's Cup to the top company in its network of 785 relocation brokers and firms. CPHPW was recognized for its accomplishments in effective marketing, customer service, and inventory management. At Work Group opens new Cary Staffing Agency office. At Work Group, a national staffing franchisor, has established a new franchise in Cary, led by Triangle staffing professional Gail Phillips. The staffing agency will help serve the region's staffing needs in hospitality, light industrial trades, and several other industries. Phillips spent the majority of her career in education, then as program manager at Education Data Systems Incorporated, where she focused on contracts with state agencies to help those who were unemployed find a job. Shuckers owners launch new event catering space. Kevin and Amy Marksberry, owners of the now closed Shuckers Oyster Bar and Grill at 510 Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh's Glenwood South, have opened Shuckers Catering and Events at the same location. The site features an event space and outdoor patio with capacity for groups up to 300, along with on-site catering. Off-site catering is also available for business meetings, backyard barbecues, oyster roasts, social gatherings, weddings, rehearsal dinners, and in-home events, including birthdays, holidays, and graduations. The Mark's Berry's Shuckers Oyster Bar and Grill in Wake Forest is still open. And with our final minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Cody Ball, Financial Manager, HH Architecture. Armed with a degree in accounting, Cody Ball has parlayed his position as a business manager at HH Architecture into the financial manager role at the firm. As financial manager, Ball oversees all financial contracts for the firm and acts as the liaison between the team and the client to negotiate agreements for successful projects. He's also responsible for forecasting, accounts payable, accounts receivable, and other accounting functions. Founded in 2005, HH Architecture is a full-service design firm focused on learning, wellness, and recreation facilities. The 12-person Raleigh firm is helmed by Kristen Hess. The firm is working on various projects in the Triangle, including a Forest Science Research and Assessment Center for the USDA Forest Service, projects for the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Cultural Services, and renovation work at Wake Tech Community College. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? How great our office culture is here at HH Architecture. We have a unique working environment where our entire office works collaboratively to produce a successful product for our client. Each project is a process from the beginning to the end, and we all work toward the overall goal of providing wonderful customer service. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? How great our office culture is here at HH Architecture. We have a unique working environment where our entire office works collaboratively to produce a successful product for our client. And we'll have to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.